Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds.
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-hosts Jake Towne and Gene DiNardo. It is Thursday, June 14, 2012. Here are some of the headlines we're looking at today. Well, there's a lot of stuff going on from across the pond. We're going to be looking at what's happening in Egypt, Greece, and Spain. We're also going to get a little report from Gene about government expenditures as a percentage of GDP from countries around the world. And then domestically, we're going to be looking at a few things of interest, including emails that may be highlighting some healthcare deals, as well as a homeless man, and this was really pathetic, who found a bunch of money and couldn't keep it. Well, you'll have to stay tuned for the details on that. But first, let's find out from Jake what's been going on over in Egypt, because a Supreme Court ruling over there has really ignited, fury. There's no other word for it.
Yeah, this just came out today, Walt, that the Egyptian court, constitutional court, has issued two rulings that are sparking anger and confusion just days, 2 days ahead of a presidential runoff election. They have declared that there was a parliamentary law that barred the former officials from the Mubarak regime from running for office, which clears the way for his former prime minister, Ahmed Shafik, to compete in the presidential election runoff. He placed second to the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate, Mohamed Morsi, in the first round of voting in late May. A lot of people are out in the streets wondering exactly what they need to do to get rid of the Mubarak regime. The second ruling ruled that one-third of the Egyptian legislature was elected illegally, which makes, according to the Egypt's constitutional court, which makes the entire parliament unconstitutional, and so that the entire lower house of parliament, the People's Assembly, must be dissolved. There's understandably a lot of people very upset in the streets. Following the overthrow of Mubarak, the Egyptian military seized power in a military coup, and there were, you know, which was highly funded, as we've talked about on the show many times, and bankrolled by U.S. Tax dollars and foreign aid. So it's quite interesting developments as I guess the Arab Spring just kind of continues to roll on.
Absolutely. And if I read it correctly, maybe you can correct me on this, it looked like the basis for the Supreme Court's ruling in essentially dissolving Parliament was that supposedly one-third of the seats were supposed to be for independent candidates, and that didn't happen. Is that what you saw?
That could be the case. The article that I'm reading from doesn't have the exact specifics. So... if that's the
because
case,
I do know that it was the Muslim Brotherhood that reacted so strongly and mightily to this ruling by the Supreme Court. So if that's the case, and if it's because the elections were held in such a way that independent candidates who were not backed by a political party did not get one third of the seats that they were supposed to, I can see where that would be really the basis for a political struggle on the highest order.
Yeah, that's possible. I don't know the details of the Egyptian parliament, but certainly the Muslim Brotherhood would be active because the prime competitor, their candidate, has now been declared able to compete in the runoff that finished second, the Shafik guy. So I think it's no surprise that the Muslim Brotherhood would protest. But I think there's plenty of other people protesting. Some of the... stuff that was done on the ground by the American-based reporters hinted that there's also movements out there. There's people talking about spoiling their ballot, in other words, not voting for either candidate. Because I guess in the runoff election, they really will have one of two people. And should he get declared not eligible, I'm not quite sure what would have happened, but it seems like the Muslim Brotherhood guy would have been a slam dunk.
Jake, do you know the voting procedures they're using? Is this new procedures or based on what they had before and they're kind of propped up government, or is this all? Is this all kind of new?
That's a real good question. I don't know the details on this. Of course, they were under dictatorship for a very long time, and so the whole idea of people actually getting to vote, I'm sure, is kind of new.
Yeah, that could be confusing.
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever you have a new democracy, all kinds of things are going to happen until things get ironed out, no doubt about that. Meanwhile, in Greece, the economy is continuing to shrink after, in the aftermath, we should say, of the previous election that didn't work out right, followed by all the speculation that's now rife within the financial markets regarding the euro and Greece splitting company and going separate ways. Greece is now seeing a yearly rate of 6.5% against a backdrop of what this one article at Reuters is calling painful wage cuts, tax hikes, and record unemployment. To look at it in even further detail, the first quarter gross domestic product preliminary projection was based on seasonally unadjusted data. It topped a previous minus 6.2% year-on-year flash estimate and follows a 7.5% year-on-year GDP decline in the last quarter of 2012. Statistics service Elstat reporting on that. So Greece continues to suffer tremendously. As a matter of fact, consumer spending has apparently fallen by around 7.5%, and investment capital has plunged about 21%. The recession now in its fifth straight year weakened imports, helping to reduce the trade deficit by 41.9% and partly contained the contraction in gross domestic product, and it goes on and on. So Greece continues to suffer mightily, and in fact, the problems also go on in Spain. Jake, Spain, first of all, they got their bailout this week, but there's also been quite a bit of fallout from that, hasn't there?
Well, today Moody's came out and slashed Spanish debt three more notches from A3 to BAA3, which I guess would be BA3, which is just like a couple, one or two notches above junk, which they joined kind of like the Fitch downgrade. Moody's is now one notch above junk. S&P's is two notches higher, so three notches above junk and Fitch is two notches above junk, and all three of them have a negative outlook, meaning that's highly likely that the rating will continue to fall. And also the small American independent Egan Jones ratings firm decided to pick on France today and lowered France's credit rating from A to triple B. So not quite getting near junk, but it's moving along that way. They left a negative outlook on it, saying that the new government under François Hollande needs to make good on its campaign promises, but that the fallout from that is most likely going to hurt the Spanish credit rating. So Egan Jones historically has preceded Mitch, S&P, and Moody's in downgrading sovereign debt, and you know, based on that pattern, we could easily see France downgrade by the big three of the U.S. Rating firms.
But I haven't heard anything in the media about France being unable to get loans or be in serious trouble yet. Anyway, that I haven't heard it. Have you heard any?
Well, you know, they're just like any other country. They're relying on the European Central Bank to bail it out, and Germany, I guess, to the same extent. So there's a kind of a big power struggle going on, and we talked about this at length last week, how these stresses on having this one national currency under is certainly causing a lot of strife in Europe, and as we speculated last week, probably won't work out, or at least in the same shape that it's currently in.
Did you guys see the numbers on the Spanish 10-year bond yields yesterday? It hit 6.998%, so 0.02 of a point below the magic 7% figure where they say that the Spanish debt will be unsustainable. It's almost like the market was playing chicken with that number. Just amazing how close it came. Today it's at 6.91% at 10:49, so backed off slightly, but definitely flirting with that magic 7% 5% number, which is where everybody agrees. I mean, at least I've never heard anybody who's contradicted it, which is the idea that if Spanish debt goes above the 7% rate in terms of its yield, then it becomes an unsustainable situation.
Oh, yeah, and that number could just kind of comes from basic math and compounding, but I think, you know, in terms of it being a miraculous level, I think if it goes above there and stays there for an extended period of time, meaning, you know, a few months or something, I think that's big trouble. Big trouble.
Two tiny points shy.
So my question is, are these countries that are, not to take advantage of tragedy, but are these countries that are having problems going to be good places to take inexpensive vacations for our travelers out there?
Maybe someday.
Someday, yeah.
The question is, how much will the U.S. dollar be worth?
Yeah,
right.
You have to remember, it's all a race to the bottom in terms of who can debase their currency the fastest. Meanwhile,
yeah, so hopefully Greece will take the lead to spur their vacation.
Great winter.
They're probably the most likely place.
Beautiful country, that's for sure.
Yeah, great climate, good food.
All this discussion about what's been going on with the euro currency and the countries involved, the weaker countries, has led to some people, particularly our own Gene DiNardo, to ask the question, just what is the situation with sovereign debt with countries around the world? And Gene, you took some time to put together a report. What did you find out?
Yeah, this is an amazing chart. It's for 2011, last year. It's put out by the Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal. And what they listed, I believe it's every country in the world, and they put the government expenditures of each country as a percentage of their gross domestic product. They also listed tax burden as a percentage of gross domestic product of each country, and I'm not sure how they got the tax burden, because that's kind of a tough thing to narrow down, but there were some facts before. In 2010, the United States per capita spending was $11,041. The world average for all the countries is $2,376. The average for the 20 largest economies was $16,110. So that's kind of interesting. And to stick with the U.S., let me go down here to the United States. The tax burden for the percentage of gross domestic product was 26.9%. The government spending, and this is in 2011, was 38.9%, so almost 40%. And you have to remember, we have a fairly large population, but just we do have the highest gross domestic product in the world, don't we? I think that's true. And so we spend 40%, almost 40% of that is spent by the government. It's just a phenomenal amount. Two countries that are kind of interesting. Yemen, the tax burden percentage of gross domestic product was 7.3%, yet the government expenditures was 43%. And I imagine, do they have oil? Is that an oil country? Because a lot of the oil countries had low tax burdens because, you know, the government just steals the oil.
They do. They also have a civil war going on, too.
Yeah, they have a civil war, so they probably can't collect the taxes. And here's another good one. Zimbabwe, which collects 31% of the GDP in taxes, provides the government expenditures provide 97.8% of the gross domestic product. So they are basically the entire economy. There are some things that stood out. A lot of the high tax countries, Austria, 42.9%, and the gross government expenditures was almost 50%. Belgium is 46% of the percentage of GDP for tax burden, and the government expenditures were 50%. Germany, 40%, with a 43% percentage of expenditures for the gross domestic product. Italy was actually, this was kind of interesting. I thought the tax burden in Italy was lower, but the tax burden is 43% of the GDP, and their government expenditures are 48.8%. So a lot of the European countries, another one is the Netherlands, which was almost 40% for the tax burden, and the government expenditures were 45%. It's interesting, but Communist China, their tax burden, and Jake, you might know an insight, have some insight on this, but their tax burden is only listed at 18%, and their government expenditures is listed at 20%, which is kind of struck me for a communist country that those figures seem low. I don't know.
Well, China doesn't have an income tax.
What's that?
China doesn't have an income tax up until a reasonable for the average Chinese doesn't pay any income tax.
Huh. So their tax burden is actually fairly low then.
Well, they do charge companies, especially foreign ones, quite a bit, so they get their money somehow, but maybe not directly through that way.
Yeah, that was it seemed like a lot of the oil countries had low tax burdens because they directly collected from oil or whatever. Interesting one here, Equatorial Guinea, the tax burden was 0.9%. Yet they spend, their expenditures per percentage of GDP is 25.5. A couple of the other, Libya is very low, 3.4% tax burden, and the government expenditures are 43% of the GDP, which probably has a lot to do with oil, as Kuwait was 1.5, yet their government expenditures are 31.8%. Nigeria was 5.9, another oil country, I believe, and their expenditures were 30%. Saudi Arabia, 6.6. And that's about it for the interesting stuff. Pakistan, even though it's a troubled country, still manages to collect 10% of the GDP. It's pretty interesting. You know, it goes all over the map, but it seems... all the countries have a good grab on their economies, and kind of goes together with the nature of government, I think, as we know it anyway.
I guess there's nothing really surprising there. Well, thank you for that. We have a guest who's going to be joining us today. David Cobb, the former Green Party presidential candidate, is going to join us in just a minute or so to talk about a campaign that he's involved with. And it's going to be very fascinating to hear about. I won't even spoil it by telling you about it. I'll just say to hang around until after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Yep, run back to your radio. Turn up the dial because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And joining us today, David Cobb. David is National Projects Director of Democracy Unlimited. He is a lawyer and political activist. He has sued corporate polluters, lobbied elected officials, run for political office himself, and has been arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience. He truly believes we must use all the tools in the toolbox to effect the systemic social change we so desperately need. In 2002, he ran for Attorney General of Texas, and he was the presidential candidate of the Green Party in 2004. David Cobb, welcome to the Freedom News Hour.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on with you. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure to have you. And the reason we had you on is we received a very interesting press release that said that you are working with a group called Move to Amend, which is also working with Ben & Jerry's co-founder Ben Cohen and joining forces with Occupy Wall Street personnel to do something rather unusual. What is it that you guys are going to be doing?
Well, let me give some context, if I can, before we talk about this really exciting, creative project.
Oh, sure.
The Move to Amend Coalition is a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition of groups and individuals from across the country coming together to demand to abolish the illegitimate, court-created legal doctrine that allows corporate lawyers to overturn democratically enacted laws on the basis that our laws can somehow violate corporations' constitutional rights. And this, secondly, abolish the also illegitimate, also court-created doctrine that money equals speech, which has been used to overturn and gut campaign finance laws, most famous and most egregiously in the Citizens United case, opening up the floodgates to literally billions of dollars from corporate money, special interest money, union money, to wealthy are able to spend unlimited amounts of money for the first time in the history of the United States, and even foreign corporations. So you know, in other words, corporate personhood and money in elections has become really the flashpoint for how the ruling elite are not only hijacking our country, our economics, but our elections, and using our legal system to legitimize the theft. And so we're calling for a social movement that will demand a constitutional remedy to amend our Constitution to make it clear that we, the people, are sovereign. We have the ability to write laws to control either corporate harms or abuse, and we can control the integrity of the electoral process. Those are political issues, not constitutional issues. So with that as a way of background, you know, we've been working with Occupy encampments across the country. Worth pointing out that Move to Amend would never dare to speak for Occupy, but we are very happy and pleased that we have frequently collaborated with Occupy on a number of fronts. The most recent being where we will be joining Occupy activists from across the country July 4th in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And could there be a more appropriate place for a movement to gather in this country for democracy on July 4th in Philadelphia? And we'll be launching our Stampede campaign. And the Stampede is a campaign to stamp U.S. currency with calls to action. For example, corporations are not people, movetoamend.org. Another one, money is not speech, movetoamend.org. And then my personal favorite, this note not to be used to bribe public officials, movetoamend.org.
I do like that one as well. That's quite enjoyable. It does raise a question that I'm sure many people will ask. I'll sort of play devil's advocate here, but many people will wonder, doesn't this in some way constitute, say, desecration of U.S. currency? Isn't there some law against this?
Well, there is a law against defacing currency for the intent or purpose of taking it out of circulation. But we are obviously, as a lawyer, that's the specific intent that's required to be prosecuted under that statute. Of course, as a lawyer, the intent is incredibly important, and it is not our intent to take this money out of circulation. To the contrary, we want our money to, our stamped currency to circulate widely, and it's clear and evident that that's what we intend to do. I am not concerned at all about a criminal prosecution any more than the folks who, if you or your listeners have seen the Where's George stamp that appears on U.S. currency, tracking just for fun, to track where currency goes in this country. We don't think that we're not concerned about that. In fact, what I would say is this, that if the U.S. Department of Treasury or the U.S. federal government really wants to expend any time, energy, and resources in helping to publicize what we're doing, that would be an interesting thing for them to do. And I'd be more than happy to meet them in a court, in either a federal court or the court of public opinion to continue the dialogue on whether we have a functioning democracy in this country or not.
One of the reasons that I thought it'd be fun and interesting to have you on the program was not only to talk about this, because it's a very interesting topic, but also to get your views regarding the elastic monetary system itself. One of the things that we play on as a theme repeatedly here at the Freedom News Hour is that the elastic money supply ends up basically making the rich richer, making the poor poorer, and having a whole host of negative consequences that follow along with it. So I'm wondering if you could share with us what your views are.
Well, first and foremost, let's just be clear that currency itself really is nothing more than a medium of exchange. And if we had a truly democratic society, then the monetary system itself would actually be under the democratic control of we the people. There may be differences of opinion, and there surely would be, but there would be accountability for both the money supply itself, that is, as well, not only the physical pieces of paper circulating, which, as you probably know, only accounts to, what, about 2 to 3% of the actual, quote, money that's in the system, but also the abstraction of zeros that are just literally created by the banks through the use of fractional banking and so forth. So to me, the issue that you're raising really points out that the United States monetary system and the United States monetary supply is not under democratic control. It's actually a consortium of privately owned banks known as the Federal Reserve. These are private banks that are setting monetary policy in this country that clearly policy is being set to benefit the rich and the wealthy. The entire banking system is operating this way. And so, you know, what I would say is that we need to abolish the Federal Reserve and create a genuine public banking system that would start with a United States public bank, and then we would create a series of state and even regional and local banks literally under the control of whatever political jurisdiction it is, so that first and foremost, so that credit and money could be made available for public projects without having to pay finance charges. You know, most of the big major public projects, 10-15% of the entire project are nothing more than fees paid to banks for the privilege of abstracting zeros on a bank account. And this is our money. This is just nothing but a big fat transaction cost that's being paid. Well, it's ridiculous. And if we actually had a U.S. public bank, we could begin to immediately solve many, if not all, of the economic crisis that's facing us today.
So you must be under the impression that bankers don't actually work for their money?
Well, you know, that's a good point. I mean, the reality is that bankers don't work for their money. Actually, you know, I'm not. They are certainly doing some administration work, but really the entire way that the current banking system works, they literally create money because of fractional banking. It's a little known, little understood process, which is allowing the already filthy rich to get even filthier.
One of the questions that comes to my mind, I like a lot of what you're saying, David. And by the way, when you said abolish the Fed, you didn't hear it, but there were three silent cheers over at this end.
Yeah, we're
But, one concern that I have where the idea of creating a public bank is concerned is that ultimately the problem with an elastic money supply is that it's elastic and that it has proven to be a problem regardless of whether it was handled privately as it's handled right now by the Federal Reserve or publicly by someone who, say, is representative of the government. In fact, the history of monetary inflation and so forth shows that very, very consistently, governments tend to, whenever they have the opportunity to expand the money supply, they do, and it leads to drastic consequences. But that seems to be at odds with the opinion that you're expressing regarding establishing a public bank.
Well,
you know, I mean, I guess I would say this, that I would much prefer to have a democratic economic system rather than one where 1% or less are actually in control of these kinds of decisions. So at the end of the day, you know, the disagreement that we may have, and who knows if we spend enough time where we'd find agreement or disagreement. But these are political questions, you know, that I think that it's reasonable to have agreement or disagreement. I'm actually asking us to actually ask a first principle question. Is it actually the domain of we the people to actually be able to collectively make those decisions or not? Is it really the case that the wealthy individuals are allowed to actually control the monetary supply and basically control the economics of this country?
So let me ask you this. How would you envision, if you had this public money supply and controlled by the public, what would determine who would be in control of the spending is, I guess, the question. I mean, would agencies?
Well, I mean,
everything.
You know, I really came on to talk about Move to Amend, so I'm not an expert on public banking, but it would be pretty obvious that what you would have is the same way you have a public regulatory commission around, you know, electric utility rates or water districts or any of the other institutions of society that are under democratic control, and that they would be elected and subject to being accountable to voters.
Well, you mentioned the Move to Amend purpose for being on the show, so let's touch on that again. What goals are you guys setting for yourselves by engaging this campaign? In other words, what would you see as a positive verdict, so to speak, a positive result from this campaign?
Well, we are very sincere. We expect to amend the United States Constitution within a decade. And that constitutional amendment is on our website, movetoamend.org. The proposed amendment is very clear and straightforward. Only human beings have constitutional rights. Artificial entities like corporations, whether they're for-profit or non-profit, do not have inherent inalienable constitutional rights. They have legal privileges, but those are subject to the political process. Human beings' constitutional rights are not subject to the political process, and any governmental encroachment upon our actual civil rights, we should be able to go into court and overturn them. The second amendment, or second part of our amendment, is money is not the equivalent to political speech. Therefore, money, the expenditure of money in political campaigns, can be properly regulated by local, state, or federal action to control the integrity of the electoral process. So that's our 10-year goal. Our steps along the way are to pass local resolutions in city and counties, and we've already actually passed over 200 just in the last week. Tucson, Arizona, St. Paul, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota have come online. There's over 200 local communities that have actually organized the political strength to pass those resolutions. Even beyond having elected officials pass resolutions, we have successfully put on the ballot the question to citizens to weigh in on advisory opinions. And everywhere we've put that on the ballot, we've won by over 70, 75, 80% of the vote. These are landslide victories, including in both traditionally liberal and traditionally conservative jurisdictions. So, you know, we're building a political movement, and ultimately we intend to politicize it to the point that any elected official is going to have to take a position. Do you believe corporations are persons with constitutional rights? Will you support a constitutional amendment to correct the court's illegitimate creation of corporate constitutional rights? And, you know, so there are a number of steps along the way, as you suggest, but the ultimate goal, which we do intend to win, is to amend the United States Constitution with the 28th Amendment.
Hey, David, I had just one comment on the whole idea of writing on these dollar bills, and that is, like, during I ran for office myself, and a lot of the cash that came in had some people just wrote "End the Fed" over the president's face, and some people wrote they had like a red stamp, like "Abolish the Fed," and they got lots of dollar bills or $20 bills that was marked in this way. I just want to caution you that when these go to a bank, the banks segregate marked bills out and mark them for destruction. And so they won't necessarily see a whole lot of circulation. The user just takes it to a bank. And the other issue is the banks, the dollar bills are toxic waste, literally. The inks have a lot of heavy metals in them. So when these go to the Fed for destruction, they end up going to a landfill. And it's a massive amount every day. Like, just one of the Federal Reserve Bank fills up two dumpsters with compacted bricks every week. I think that's the Chicago Fed. And the ink that's in these dollars bills contain mercury, arsenic, cyanide, aldehyde, believe it or not, lithium, valium, zinc, kind of like the pretty nasty stuff. But at any rate, I just wanted to let you know that that's probably what's going to happen when these get to back to a bank. But back to what you were mentioning with the monetary system, the public banking, do you think the money should be backed by anything, or should it just be like, you know, what we currently have today, which is, you know, just entries on a computer, more or less?
Well, you know, I haven't actually thought about that very deeply, so I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
You know, I have an idea I've heard. I kind of was wondering your opinion on this, was that about the corporations and the campaign funding, that only individuals should be allowed to fund political campaigns or send money to political funds. Do you agree with that, or have any idea?
Yeah, you know, I've heard there are certainly a lot of people who are supporting a move to amend who take that position, and it's a totally rational, reasonable position to take. I take the position that we should have full publicly funded elections and get all money out of the elections, because elections are the infrastructure of the Democratic Republic. And just as we have public infrastructure for roads and sewer and wastewater and electricity and so forth, that we should have the infrastructure for the Democratic Republic. But the point that I want to go again is that that is a political discussion, and it should actually be had in the body politic through the elected process, and then elected officials would then have be empowered to make campaign finance laws locally, state and federal, and in some jurisdictions where folks would agree. And I'm sorry, I couldn't catch your first name.
Oh, Gene.
Gene, your point about individuals can only individuals can contribute, then if that was the political will of elected representatives, that would be the answer. In other jurisdictions where the argument for full publicly funded elections won the day, then that would be the answer. But again, those are political questions that the court has taken away from us and said, no, those are constitutional issues. The people do not have the authority through their elected representatives to actually make these kinds of laws.
Yeah, that's a great point. I agree. It should be in the local communities, and the court has done that in a number of issues. But personally, I might be for, like, not allowing any funding of elections. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I do think that it's interesting that again, we have a lot of people in Move to Amend who have differences of opinion on multiple issues across the board, but what we have found where we can find common ground are the constitutional principles. We the people are sovereign. We have the authority to rule. The only role for the court is to interpret laws and to overturn any laws if they actually violate the civil liberties or the rights of actual human beings. Other than that, this should all be political debate and discourse.
I almost want to play the role of devil's advocate here to point out that the way that we got to this place in the first place, to the situation in the first place, actually has a long history. I mean, it goes back to the Civil War, it goes back to the creation of the Fed, and so on and so forth. Those were all democratically taken actions. And indeed, leading up to questions about whether or not there should be limitations placed on contributions to political office, those were also politically taken actions. I can't say that I totally agree with the Supreme Court's ruling. I don't think that the way they handled it was correct. But I do think there's an argument to be made that there is a speech component to money. In the current context, that's perhaps a verboten thing to say because of all the negative stuff that currently surrounds the issue. But I mean, the idea that it's not a form of speech basically is one step away from the society, the body collective can tell people how to spend their money. And that's a very, very disturbing point from my perspective. What do you think?
Well, I think that, with all due respect, I think you just made a leap that I honestly cannot even really follow. The question of who actually has the ultimate authority, who is the sovereign, is it really going to be five members of the United States Supreme Court that can tell 300 million of us how our Constitution is to be interpreted? And, again, political decisions are ones that can be agreed or disagreed with, but they can also be corrected politically. When the court exercises its claim for judicial review to overturn decisions, the only remedy that we have is through amendment or revolution. Those are the only remedies that remain to us. So the court, in the case of creating corporate constitutional rights and creating money as speech, I think has done the same sort of thing that they did when they said women are not persons for the purposes of the 14th Amendment in the Minor versus Happersett case, or the case that a black man has any rights that a white man is bound to respect. I mean, when the court has so perverted the framework of the constitutional republic, it's up to we the people to correct them. And, you know, I respect it that we may have a difference of opinion about how these political questions should be answered and where, and again, where these issues are. But I think that we can have agreement that ultimately the people are sovereign in this country and that that means something. And again, the one time that I think that the people cannot, the majority can never actually violate the constitutional rights of individuals, whether they're political minorities, racial or ethnic minorities. So that's, I think, where the key is. The role for the court is to interpret laws or to overturn any laws if actual human rights are being violated by the majority.
Well, we might disagree with what they decided to do in this case, but really that's the leg that they were standing on the leg that they felt that a given right was being trampled on and they were defending it. So we may not like the ruling that they undertook, but basically that was the basis for their ruling, that they were,
yes, and they
are carrying out a constitutionally mandated rule.
Okay, then I think they're wrong.
Well, is the whole federal republic idea no longer an idea to be kept around? Because, I mean, that's the role that they were acting upon when they made a decision.
So are you telling me with the Supreme Court that's final? We don't have a serious
phone. Could you reach that?
I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand what it is that you're that, what is the conclusion that you're drawing? Do we or do we not have the authority and the right to amend the Constitution?
We do have the authority and the right to amend the Constitution. That really raises the question about how this impacts the structure of the federal government as it's currently enshrined.
Well, it would not. It would keep the three branches intact. It would actually return the power to the people and shift the power away. I mean, what is happening now is a legalization of the theft of the American Constitutional Republic, putting it in the hands of a small ruling elite. And frankly, most people, because it's the court, have just said, okay, well, I guess that's how we have to handle it because that's what the court has said. I'm proud to be part of a growing movement that across political ideologies, across party labels, that are saying, yeah, basta. Enough already. This is not right. We have the authority to exercise our sovereign right. The court has overstepped its bounds, and it's up to we, the people, to act.
Well, David, we're reaching the end of the segment here, and I'm sorry we had trouble hearing some of what you were saying, but I think there's some wind there or something where you're talking. But thank you very much for joining us on the program, and good luck with your movement.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
And we will be back after these messages. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
And we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And just a reminder before we get back to the headlines, you can always check out upcoming guests by visiting the website, www.freedomnewshour.com, or you can always check the archives to find out about old shows. Listen to previous broadcasts we've done both on our site and on the site for the station, prn.fm, so be sure to check that out. Getting back to the headlines, I want to touch on one quickly that just struck my attention when Jake handed it to me. And Jake, I'm going to let you tell the story, but why is it that a homeless man can't keep money that he finds?
Well, this is a real-life story out of the heart of Texas. And a 46-year-old Timothy Yost near Houston, while homeless, was passing through the town of Bastrop, Texas, found on the side of a road edge of a bag sticking out of the ground on the banks of the Colorado River on January 18th, about 35 miles southeast of Austin. He kicked it, heard a rattling sound, and he started digging, and eventually he unearthed a bag of 70$100 bills, so $7,000, very wet, and plastic sleeves of gold coins totaling 77,000. I think it was 40 ounces of gold. which is probably somewhere around $70,000 worth. He took the damp money to the nearest bank and tried to exchange the wet bills for dry currency. The teller alerted the town police. Yost was up front and told him how he found it, where he found it. Then the officers took all the money and the gold coins from him and gave him a receipt as evidence. And no one has claimed the money after several months. They stored the cash in their evidence vault for a month. They ran a local official notice in the local newspaper. No one came forward, and under the Texas Finders Keepers law, he got the Bastrop City Council held a hearing and voted to return the money to Yost. But the only problem was Yost was tossed in jail. So he's currently serving mostly for trespassing and public intoxication charges. His latest arrest, he was arrested 8 times since September. His latest arrest was May 29th for criminal trespass and public intoxication, so he's being held at the jail. Eventually, the city officials say they expect to turn the money over to Yost's attorneys, and I guess when he gets out, he'll be able to do some stuff. And the reporter also did some records and saw that Thursday morning he posted $6,500 bond and was released. So maybe that was where the $7,000 went.
So he does get to keep the money eventually. Is that the root of the story or the end of the story?
Yeah, he does get to keep the money. It took 6 months, though, and I think it's kind of honorable that he was very honest where it came from.
Well, actually, didn't it say they turned the money over to his attorney, so that means he'll probably get a small percentage of it.
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah, maybe the attorneys are done with their bills and fees. Oof. That's rough stuff. Well, I think we'll hope for the best for Mr. Yost, and maybe he can turn his life around with this newfound money, and we'll think good thoughts for him. Meanwhile, Gene has unearthed some rather interesting emails about healthcare and the deal making that goes on regarding healthcare. And Gene, what have you found out?
Yeah, this is an interesting article. It brings up the subject of reimportation, which kind of sounds like it should be in the immigration area, but it isn't. I'll read a little bit from the article. This kind of talks about the period when they were crafting the healthcare plan under President Obama. After weeks of talks, drug industry lobbyists were growing nervous to cut a deal with the White House on overhauling healthcare. They needed to be sure that President Barack Obama would stop a proposal by his liberal allies intended to bring down medicine prices. On June 3, 2009, one of the lobbyists emailed Nancy Ann DeParlay, the president's healthcare advisor. DeParlay reassured the lobbyists, although Obama was overseas, she wrote, she and other top officials had, and this is quote, made decision based on how constructive you guys have been to oppose importation. Just like that, Obama's staff signaled a willingness to put aside support for the reimportation of prescription medicines at lower prices, and by doing so solidified a compact with the industry he had vilified on the campaign trail. Central to Obama's drive to remake the nation's healthcare system was an unlikely collaboration with the pharmaceutical industry that forced unappealing trade-offs. The email exchange that day 3 years ago was among the cache of messages obtained from the industry and released in recent weeks by House Republicans, including a new batch put out on Friday morning detailing the industry's advertising campaign supporting Obama's health care overhaul. Without the deal in which the industry agreed to provide $80 billion to expand coverage in exchange for protection of policies that would cost more, Obama calculated he might get nowhere, which is how they came to the agreement. This is all done behind closed doors, which is another thing he campaigned against. But the interesting thing is this concept of reimportation. We've all heard of people who drive up, who live close to Canada, and they'll drive up there and buy their prescription drugs at 30 to 50% of the cost of the American when they're sold in America. Also, if you're in New Mexico, the drug prices in Mexico are probably one-tenth of the drug prices here, or maybe even less, because basically people can't afford it. Now, these drugs, a lot of them, they're manufactured in America. They're sold to the Canadians at a discounted price from what we pay. It is illegal to bring them back in any manner other than for your personal use. It's against the law. This just amazed me, and that's what they call reimportation. So what the Obama administration agreed to is to keep this in place so that companies, as absurd as it might seem, couldn't go up to Canada, buy a truckload of drugs, and bring them back here and sell them for cheaper, or maybe, you know, maybe compete with the price here. And I just found that amazing. I mean, talk about corporatism. So that's in that part of the health care bill, and it's actually come up to vote again, and there's no clear-cut. I was kind of doing some research on it. There's no clear-cut partisan lines on this. It just depends. I mean, some Democrats are for this law. Some are against it. Some Republicans are for it. Some are against it. McCain is one who spoke out against it, but other Republicans have voted for against actually taking this law away and allowing the reimportation. So it's pretty crazy. But anyway, that's our free economy.
I can't help but imagine, too, that there's probably a link to patents and copyrights going on here.
I think you got a good point there, Walt.
Yeah, I think it's probably what's really going on, because most often when you look at what happens within the realm of American patent, American copyright law, especially with patent law, they're trying to keep prices as high as possible to the American consumer. And it happens in market after market, with product after product. I just can't help but think that the same thing is going on here.
It could be. It could be Canada has more lax. I know Mexico has very lax patent laws, and, of course, their health care costs are a small fraction of ours. We spend a lot of our time, the U.S. government, trying to force our patent laws on other countries, particularly China, which has very lax laws, and that's part of the what the American government does to push corporatism on the rest of the world, really.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left here, and Jake has brought to our attention an article that has a positive side to it. We like to end on a positive note whenever we can. So, Jake, what do you have for us?
Right, and this is coming out of the Army Times, and the military, with the repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, has the Pentagon has announced that they will mark June as Gay Pride Month for any troops that are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgenders. So I think this is a very great step forward and for really the country. I'm not quite sure when they have the heterosexual holiday or announcement, but at this point in time, with everything that's been going on, I think it's very admirable that the military is at least taking this step, to recognize the service and the professionalism of troops.
This is quite a change, too. This is quite a shift for the Pentagon, because as of even just a year ago, I mean, the Pentagon was almost uniformly standing strong against this whole idea of shifting away from Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And now to put on a gay pride event, wow, that's a major shift.
Yeah, that's a big turnaround. I agree.
No doubt about that. Well, we actually have about a minute left. I'm not sure if we have time to do an article or not. Maybe what I'll do is I'll do a little piece of an article. Foreclosure activity. We haven't talked about that in a long time, but foreclosures, according to RealtyTrack, rose by 9% in May from a month earlier to 205,990 total properties. The jump in foreclosure activity is likely because lenders are finally getting to a backlog of homes they might have started foreclosing on last year, if not for the robo-signing crisis. So it looks like, as has been predicted for quite a few months now, the foreclosure wheels are back in full rotation again. And with that, gentlemen, I think we've reached the end of the time allotted to us. But as usual, it's been a pleasure.
It has, and we'll see you all again next week.
Absolutely. See you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.